Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Drive Nation podcast. We're now on episode 4. I'm Dan Prosser, joined once again by Andrew Frankel. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, Dan. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Now, it's for a very sad reason that Andrew and I are sitting down to record this podcast today. That is the passing of the incomparable Sir Stirling Moss. He died on Easter Sunday morning at the age of 90. A sad reason indeed, but I don't think that word will describe the tone of this podcast, because this will be a celebration of everything that he achieved in a racing car, and what's more, of the man he was outside of one. Andrew, we'll talk at length about his career and him as a person, but before that, we should say now that Sir Stirling Moss was not only a hero to you, but also a friend. Can you tell us how you got to know him?
Yeah, he was. I mean, geez, there are so many things that I have over the years had cause to feel lucky about for being in this business, but there can't be many, if any, which have made me feel more fortunate than to be able to say that, I mean, to this day, decades after I first met him, to say that Stirling was my friend. You know, we went to each other's birthday parties. We hung out together. He was an enormous help to me in my career when I was editing Motorsport magazine. We used to just dig out old pictures from archives with nothing on the back, and there'd just be a collection of racing drivers, and none of us knew who they were. So we'd just fax them across to Stirling. And he'd just come back with sort of line-by-line details on everybody in them. And it was never too much trouble. He was always a great friend to me professionally, and over the years, that friendship became a personal friendship. I mean, to be honest with you, the first time I met him, I think it was in about 95, I went down to chase the Mille Miglia, and he was in his old 300 SLR Mercedes, driving like, Stirling Moss, really. And I can remember he came past me once, just going at an amazing speed and trying to keep up with him. I think I was in a Porsche 968 Cabriolet and just having no chance at all and being so impressed. But then there was some stop and we had to queue up to get our food somewhere. And there was a big long queue. And Stirling had many, many qualities, but patience was never high up that list. And I can just remember him just being this brooding, bad-tempered person. And it was one of those sort of, you know, do you really want to meet your heroes moments? And I really questioned whether this had been the moment where, you know, the image I had of my hero was about to be shattered before me. It was only later on that I discovered that he was, you know, quite a shy person, and so utterly different in private to how, you know, I saw him there in public sitting in a queue somewhere in Italy.
An enormous privilege just to have met the guy, but to have become his friend, that's extraordinary. And I think that's why this is going to be actually a very personal tribute from you to him in this episode. We'll come back to that and talk about that in much more detail later on. But to get us started, I want to go right the way back to the start, which was September 17th, 1929, when Stirling Moss was born in London. His father was Alfred Moss, a London dentist, and he, actually I didn't realise this, Andrew, until I started doing some background reading for this episode, but his father was an amateur racing driver himself, finished 16th in the Indy 500 in 1924.
Yeah, I mean that's what a thing to grow up with. You know, dad did the Indy. I mean, what a thing to be. And Alfred's role in Sterling's life really cannot be underestimated. You know, there are lots of parents who, quite understandably, particularly back then, weren't at all keen for their children to go racing because of the enormous risks that they faced. But, you know, really right up until he got snapped up by Mercedes in the mid-1950s, you know, Sterling often had to race his own cars and often had to do that with the support of his family. And Alfred was always there to provide that support. He was a fairly impressive figure in his own right.
Mother was Eileen, and she competed as well, actually, in hill climbs. So racing very much in Sterling's blood, just as it was in his younger sister's. Pat Moss, of course, a hugely successful rally driver herself. Now, Sterling began racing in 1948 and raced professionally until 62. He started in a 500cc Formula 3 Cooper. It was in 1950, at just 20 years of age, that he won a major international race for the first time, the RAC Tourist Trophy at Dundrod in Northern Ireland, in a Jaguar XK 120. He made his F1 debut the following year. Now, Andrew, we'll look at his career stats in a moment, but let's ask the big question here and now: just how good was this guy?
It's difficult, isn't it? You know, there are lots of people, and I'm probably one of them, who say you can never compare drivers across the eras. You could never compare Sterling to Senna or to Lewis, because the machinery was so different, the environments were so different. I think all you can say is that of all the racing drivers there have ever been, he was one of the very best. He's also one of the people who just shows how ridiculous statistics are. You know, this is a man who not only never won a Formula One World Championship, he never even won Le Mans, despite countless attempts. And so if you just go by the sort of, you know, the headlines, he never did the Indy 500. He wouldn't figure very high up at all. But, you know, you ask anybody who knows anything about this game to name certainly their top 10. And, you know, he would not only be in there, but I would think on most people's list, he'd be on the top in the top half of it. He was not just extraordinarily quick. Where I thought he was very different was that, unlike a lot of racing drivers, he was incredibly versatile too. You know, stick him in a sports car, a Formula One car, a rally car, a saloon car, tin top, and he was just, I mean, it didn't matter to him. He was just quick.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so let's look at the stats themselves, but we'll also look beyond the stats. So, as you said, no F1 championships. He won 16 F1 Grand Prix, which is a good haul of race wins, but he did it in only 66 starts, which gives him almost a 25% winning ratio. That's very nearly a match for Ayrton Senna's. And now if we apply that winning ratio to a modern Formula One career, you know, a driver nowadays might start 200 races, maybe even 300 races. Sterling Moss would have been looking at 50, 60 plus race wins, comparable with Vettel, Prost, the biggest names in the game. It's instructive as well to look at who has fewer F1 wins than Moss has. One behind him with 15 race wins is Jenson Button, of course, the 2009 world champion. Behind Button, you've got Jack Brabham, a triple champion. And then behind Brabham, you've got three double champions: Graham Hill, Emerson Fittipaldi, and Alberto Ascari. Moss won more races than all of those guys. So for Moss, perhaps more than anybody else ever to have stepped into a racing car, the raw numbers do his genius at the wheel no justice whatsoever.
There is one other thing I would stick in there, and having said that the statistics prove nothing, there is one particular Moss stat which I do like. Because cars broke a lot back then, particularly cars that Sterling drove, for a couple of reasons. If you take out all his retirements and just look at the races that he actually finished, he won 56% of them, which meant that if Sterling finished a race, the chances were the best you could hope to do was come second.
Incredible, isn't it? Really? Wow, that's a great stat. That really does give you a good picture of what a fearsome and dominant competitor he was in a racing car. So no F1 titles, Andrew, but how close did he come?
Well, he came second four times. The closest he came was in 1958, when he really should have been the Formula One world champion. Mike Hawthorn, as many will recall, won it, and he won it like very few other Formula One world champions. He won it with just a single victory throughout the course of the year, whereas Stirling, in the same year, won four races. The difference was that Mike Hawthorn was in a Ferrari, which was not only a very quick car, it was also an extremely reliable car. And Stirling, preferring to race British cars, Coopers and Vanwalls, was often let down by his machinery. But really, he took the title away from himself that year. If anybody has read the post on Drive Nation, I have mentioned this on there. But in 1958, at the Portuguese Grand Prix, Mike Hawthorn was disqualified from that race because he spun the car and reversed back up the track. And it came to appeal, and Stirling spoke in his rival's defence at the appeal and said that far from being on the track, he was actually on the pavement at the time, which wasn't part of the racetrack. Therefore, he hadn't reversed up the track. Therefore, he shouldn't be disqualified. His points should be reinstated. Hawthorn got his points back. He came second in that race. And at the end of the season, Stirling lost that title to Mike Hawthorn by a single point.
So really, it was his sporting principles that meant he was never an F1 world champion rather than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine Sebastian going to Lewis's appeal and saying, no, you've got to reinstate this guy because he was on the pavement at the time.
Yeah.
It's not really something you can envisage these days.
I'm not sure we have those characters in Formula One anymore. Andrew, you spoke about Stirling Moss being a very adaptable driver. He raced at Le Mans several times. He never really had the same level of success there.
No, he didn't. He never liked the race. He, to be honest, he didn't really regard it as a race because he couldn't go flat out. And in Stirling's mind, if you were managing the machinery, then you know you weren't racing. And so he always regarded it as something that he kind of had to do. He would have won it, I think undoubtedly, in 1955 when he was sharing with Fangio. I mean, what a driver lineup that was in the Mercedes-Benz, the W196. Had Mercedes not withdrawn the team after the terrible accident that befell Pierre Levesque and over 80 members of the crowd at the time. But he never did. And, you know, he would often be, because he was so fast, he would often be the bloke that was sort of sent out to break the opposition. And they'd just go, whoever is racing with, so they said, Stirling, just go out there and just drive the wheels off the thing. And, you know, and the opposition would have to follow because there was always a chance that his car would last, and then you had to be there just in case it did. And, you know, many's the time, 1959 in particular, when Aston Martin won Le Mans, where they deliberately gave Stirling a car which they knew had a weak engine in it. It was a car with four main bearings instead of seven. So that meant less internal friction, but more likely that it was going to break. And his job was to go out and break the Ferraris. And they regarded the car as semi-expendable. And he went out, he drove like the wind, did indeed do all the damage to the Ferraris that was expected of him. And although he retired and Carroll Shelby and Roy Salvadori went on to win the race, John Wire, the team manager, said, you know, quite clearly that you cannot underestimate Stirling's role in that victory.
What do we think, Andrew, was his greatest race? Is it possible that his greatest race was outside of Formula One?
Well, he always said that it was. He always said that it was the Mille Miglia in 55. I think lots of people listening to this will know all about him and Dennis Jenkinson and the, you know, the bog roll pace notes and how they drove the 922 miles from Brescia to Rome and back in 10 hours and a few minutes at an average of almost 100 miles an hour. He always said that was his greatest race. It was an astonishing feat. After the race, he went to the victory party and after that drove back to Stuttgart, which is just, you know, I mean, I've sort of done the Mille Miglia, the sort of modern parade, cavalcade, retrospective event they have these days. And I've done it over 3 and over 4 days. And that's exhausting. It really is. To drive a car when you're not racing it over those distances. And to think that he started at 22 minutes past 7 in the morning and 10 hours later was back again, it absolutely befuddles my brain. But, I mean, there are certainly other candidates for it. There was the 1000 Ks at the Nürburgring in 1959, where he was leading by a mile, had to let Jack Fairman drive the car for a bit. He binned it. Fairman somehow managed to lift the car back onto the track. Sterling got back into it, miles behind everybody else, and still managed to win. He did a very similar thing at the TT that year at Goodwood when his car caught fire, and they commandeered Carroll Shelby's car and stuck Sterling in it, and he drove through the field and won that. Monaco 61 in Rob Walker's Lotus 18 against massively more powerful, faster competitive Ferraris, held them off for the duration of the race. I think the one that people don't talk about so much, which I've always been fascinated by, is Argentina in 1958, which was an immensely hot race. And he was in a Cooper, and he convinced everybody that he would change his tyres and that his race, halfway through the race, as everybody had to, and that he had no chance of winning because the Coopers had four studs in each wheel, each of which obviously needed undoing, and therefore his pit stop would take 3 minutes and all chances of the winning the race would go. And then he got Al Francis, his team manager, to hang out pit boards, counting him down to a pit stop, which he never intended to have. And he did the entire race on the same set of tyres and ended up literally with, you know, tyres down to the canvas, bits of wire sticking out of them, and won that race, which was an incredible feat, not just of driving, but also of, you know, masterly tactics.
How do we best describe his driving style then? I mean, was he flat-out attack from flag to flag, or was he was there more sort of deftness in there? What were his sort of core attributes, do you think?
I think this is the most interesting thing about Sterling, because as he would have told you himself, the truth about Stirling Moss, in which what it must have completely fried the brains of the opposition, was that he was rarely actually on his own personal limit. If you look at the accidents that he had, and goodness knows he had a few, I can't think of one which was down to Stirling overcooking it. Whereas if you look at the drivers, his contemporaries, who died in racing cars, so many of them died because they just drove too fast and made a mistake, and it cost them their lives. And Sterling just didn't do that. And, you know, if you think you're out there chasing Sterling Moss and you are doing everything you can to keep up with this bloke, but in the back of your mind, you know he's not actually trying that hard. He always left. He's not always. He said there were a few occasions when the situation did command 100%. But he always regarded himself as a very safe driver because he always left himself that margin. And yet, despite that, he was still just so, other than the Fangio, he was just in a different league to anybody else out there.
Okay, interesting you mentioned Fangio. I know that you've spoken to a number of Moss's contemporaries about him. So can you give us an idea of what kind of regard Stirling Moss was held in by the other guys that he raced against?
Well, I mean, Fangio thought that Stirling was the greatest prospect he'd ever seen. You know, Stirling, in return, obviously, and you know, to the end of his life, Sterling always said that Fangio was the better driver, the greater driver. And I guess you'd have to say that he has some reason for that, although Sterling was always better in a sports car than Fangio. But everybody else just absolutely revered Sterling. And it was, you know, it was very, very difficult being Sterling's teammate, for what I talked about earlier, because you knew he wasn't actually going quite as fast as he possibly could. But he also, you know, he went racing in the right way. That's what I love about Sterling. You know, he was a person who was interested in safety. He wasn't some lunatic. And yet, you know, he was completely against all the measures that were brought in to make circuits less interesting and safer, because he just thought, you know, if you don't like it, don't do it. And he was a sort of, and he was, the other thing about Sterling is, you know, there were, as there are now, there were drivers who don't drive in a correct way back then as there are today. Despite the fact that he went wheel to wheel with so many people in so many races over so many years, I've never heard anyone say that Sterling cut them up, chopped them up, or did anything. I've never heard anyone say that Sterling put a bad mood on them, which I think in a career like that is just incredible.
Do you think some of the British greats that we might discuss, Graham Hill and perhaps Jackie Stewart and some of these others, do you think they always considered Moss was the benchmark?
Without being able to talk to them, I mean, Jackie Stewart was on the telly yesterday saying that Sterling was his hero. I mean, their careers, their Formula One careers, didn't quite overlap. They missed each other by a couple of years. you know, I know guys like Tony Brooks, who is, you know, who I absolutely revere as, you know, Britain's greatest, you know, unsung racing driver of that era. You know, he was always, as so many of them were, of the view that he was as good as anybody other than Stirling, and that on any day they could beat any driver out there other than Stirling. And there was just this sort of acceptance that, you know, there was Stirling in his race and then there was the rest of you in another. And, you know, Stirling could be in an uncompetitive car, or Stirling's car could break. But if you had Stirling in a reliable competitive car, you know, that was it. You were going to come second at best.
Andrew, Stirling Moss's racing career, his professional career at least, was brought to a premature end when in 1962 he had the mother of all crashes at Goodwood. What can you tell us about that and the effect of that accident?
Yeah, it was the Easter Goodwood meeting. He was driving a thing called a Lotus 1821. Nobody knows why he went off, certainly not Stirling, who was never able to recall what happened. I think the one thing that everybody has agreed on is that it was almost inconceivable that it could have been his fault. But whether he got pushed wide by another competitor or whether there was a mechanical failure on the car, the only fact that matters is that he went into the bank on the left-hand side of the entry to the right that goes into St Mary's at about 120 miles an hour. And the car penknifed around him, leaving him with, you know, quite a few broken limbs, but most significantly, you know, significant bang on the head, which put him in a coma for, I think, 5 or 6 weeks. And his life absolutely was in the balance for quite a long time. And yeah, when he came out of it, he thought he'd never be able to race again, but he didn't want to go without knowing for sure. So he went back to Goodwood as soon as he was fit enough to drive a car, and drove a thing called a Lotus 19, which was a pretty little sports car. And he did a test in the wet, just a private test, just him on the circuit by himself. And he spun the car coming out the chicane, but not to any great consequence. And what he found was that he could still lap the circuit, he could still put in competitive times, but it had become a mechanical process. He was having to try to spot braking points, try to remember where to turn in, you know, how to reapply the throttle. It wasn't natural to him anymore. And it always had been. You know, in the past, he always used to talk about, you know, driving around the circuit at race speeds, spotting pretty girls in the crowd and waving to them. He genuinely, in 1961, when he was racing Rob Walker's 250 short wheelbase Ferrari, you know, to his, I think, his seventh and final TT win. He won 7 Tourist Trophies. Anyway, he was listening to the radio. He was listening to Raymond Baxter commentating on the race he was winning. He had so much spare mental capacity that he could listen to the radio while driving away from some of the greatest drivers on earth. And I think he did end up bitterly regretting his decision after that test and that little Lotus to retire, because he thought, and probably rightly, that if he'd given himself another 6 months to heal properly, then his brain would have been, you know, in a much better position to pick it all up again, and, you know, and maybe he would have raced on, maybe he would have won many more races, maybe he would have won a world championship, and indeed maybe he would not have made it to 90 years old. Who knows?
Yeah, if he'd been able to carry on after 62, perhaps he would have raced on into the late 60s, maybe even the early 70s. I know that he looked up to Fangio, who was still racing at a good old age for a professional racing driver, well into his 40s, maybe his 50s?
Yeah, so Fangio, I mean, Stirling was always quite taken by the fact that Fangio's greatest race, you know, some would say the greatest race, Formula One race that was ever held, was the German Grand Prix in 1957. It was Fangio's last win, but it was also his greatest race. And he was 47 years old at the time. And, you know, Stirling thought to himself, well, if Fangio can still be racing and winning world championships at the age of 47, why not me? And, you know, he was 32 at the time of the Goodwood accident. And if you add 15 years to that, you get to 1977. And what you are looking at is a, you know, frontline racing career that, you know, spans, you know, almost 30 years. more to the point, spans absolutely the most dangerous time there ever was to be racing cars. And I think just on the maths alone, the chances of you doing that amount of racing, because, you know, don't forget, you know, he was racing, he wasn't just racing, you know, Formula One, he was racing Formula Two and Junior. I mean, he did so many races every single year, and the chances of something, frankly, terminal happening in one of those races, had he carried on for another 15 years, I think probably would have been quite high. So maybe, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, got to know him at all.
Yeah, so perhaps in some bizarre, strange way, that accident in 62 actually prolonged his life. Now, of course, that was the end of his professional racing career. But for decades after that, Moss was still seen racing really just for fun. And that explains how, Andrew, you were able to meet him for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Sterling was always quite motivated by money, and there's nothing wrong with that. And, you know, you can understandably, you know, if Mercedes-Benz says to you, you know, come and drive 300 SLR around the Mille Miglia course, you know, 20 years after you won it, 40 years after you won it, which is how I caught up with him in 95, then of course you do. But he did also do a huge amount of historic racing, you know, literally just for the fun of it. He owned a beautiful little car called an Oscar, OSCA, which he raced into his 80s and absolutely loved being in. And so that meant that just a few of us idiots got the chance to be on the track at the same time as him.
Yeah, and you have this incredible story, Andrew, where you found yourself on track at a Goodwood revival a few years ago, racing alongside this bloke called Stirling Moss. You have to tell us all about
this. Yeah, it sounds, I mean, it just, even now, it just sounds like a dream, doesn't it? It would have been in the early 2000s. He would have been, I think he was 77. So I would have been, you know, 40-ish. And I'm rather careful. I'm rather concerned that people are now going to think that I'm in any way comparing myself to Stirling Moss. And so just as a point of order, I am absolutely not. The point, you know, I think what you have to remember is that not only was he, you know, quite an old man even then, he was in a Lotus Cortina. He'd never sat in before. And I was in an Alpha GTA, which I'd been racing for a few seasons. So I knew it very well indeed. And, you know, so there's that. He was in a car that was also, you know, not as competitive as the Alpha that I was in. So there's those three factors. The fact he didn't know the car, the fact that the car wasn't as quick as my car, and the fact that he was, you know, quite an old bloke even then. I needed all those three factors just to level the playing field. And then, yeah, although I was in quite a large number of races with him. That's the only time I could really say that we went wheel to wheel. And we had a good old ding dong. It was, you know, part of the problem was I started up behind him and I was able to stay with him, but I didn't really want to overtake it because I was just enjoying the view out too much. You know, to be able to, I mean, just to drive around Goodwood is a pretty fun thing to do. To chase Stirling Moss in a race when you are somehow, where the dice have been loaded sufficiently so that they've rolled in your favour so you can actually keep up with the bloke. And I can remember him drifting this Lotus Cortina through Ford Water, which was a flat-out corner for both of us, but, you know, was still taken with a bit of attitude. And just sitting there thinking, I'm watching, I have a front-row seat to watching Stirling Moss drift a Lotus Cortina through Ford Water at Goodwood. You know, the circuit where he had his first race, the circuit where he had the last race of his professional career. And, you know, and for a bloke like me, you know, it just doesn't get any better than that, except it did, because when the race was over, the thing I actually remember most was going down the 11th straight on the warm down and him coming up beside me because he'd let me pass. He absolutely let me pass, which was the only reason I felt I finished ahead of him, because I think he'd looked in the mirror and just seen this idiot going at increasingly ridiculous angles in this Alpha and just thought, I better let the boy pass before he does something he'd regret. And he came up alongside me and I looked over and I just saw this thumb in the air. And there was Stirling Moss giving me the thumbs up, the big yahoo, to say he'd had such a good time racing with me. And
wow.
I don't know. I mean, honestly, it brings tears of joy to my eye just to recall that, just to think that actually happened. And yeah, to Stirling, it was a nothing. It was just, you know, one of probably thousands of races he did throughout his entire life, certainly many hundreds. To me, greatest moment in a racing car, without any question at all.
And it's even more extraordinary because he hung around to say hello to you afterwards.
Well, he came to find me. I wasn't there. It was slightly embarrassingly. But Stirling being Stirling, he, you know, a man with no ego at all, he didn't find me. He found Vernon, the mechanic. And, you know, Vernon was absolutely as good as me as someone to talk to about racing cars. So he sat in a pile of tyres and gassed with Vernon until I turned up. And I would be coming back and there was Stirling Moss just sitting there, sitting on a pile of tyres, chatting to Vernon about stuff, you know, having come over just to... I'm not going to congratulate me or anything like that, but just to share the joy of having had a bit of a tear up on a track. And it was just, it was magical. Absolutely magical.
So a hero to you, professionally very helpful to you, but you're one of a relatively small number of people, Andrew, who can actually tell us what Stirling Moss was like as a bloke. I mean, we're all flawed human beings. I'm sure he had his flaws, but can you tell us what Stirling Moss, the man, was like?
Yeah, he was a very flawed person. He was notoriously impatient. You know, he was whatever the opposite of PC. That was Stirling. He was, you know, he was. I think the phrase is of his generation. He was, you know, quite unreconstructed in a lot of his views. And, you know, and you kind of had to just, you know, either accept that or not, as you chose. And, you know, and I obviously, you know, chose that I would, because, you know, what I saw as I got to know him was that beneath this sometimes gruff exterior, was the most incredibly sweet man. His warmth and his compassion and his kindness and his humour more than anything else is what I will remember for the rest of my days. He was an immensely funny bloke. You know, funny in the right circumstances. I can remember, when was it? It would have been 2012. So the 60th anniversary of him and Norman Dewis doing the Mille Miglia in a C-type Jaguar. It's actually the race in which they proved the concept of the disc brake, but that's another story for another time. Anyway, I took, with some others, Stirling and Norman back to Brescia to celebrate this this occasion, and you can imagine they were the talk of the town. And, you know, every time they appeared in public, you know, cameras would be in his face, microphones would be up his nose. And to be honest, he didn't do terribly well in that environment. He'd get a bit flustered. His memory, you know, after the bang on the head wasn't as good as it could have been. Norman loved all that sort of stuff. He was absolutely in his element. And Stirling would largely defer to Norman, and was clearly something of a fish out of water. And then later on, when it was just four or five of you around a table and, you know, in the hotel bar or whatever, he'd just be this totally other person, this incredibly charming, funny, relaxed, I mean, just the best company in the world. And really, as much as anything else, it's those moments with Stirling that I will cherish the most. Because I guess it's because those are the moments when you feel you're actually seeing the real bloke. You're not seeing Stirling Moss the racing driver. You're not seeing Stirling Moss the brand ambassador. You're seeing Stirling Moss. And that's, yeah, immensely special.
You were very fortunate, Andrew, to race against him on circuit. But I just wonder if you ever shared a road car with him.
Yes.
Driving.
Yeah, a few times. Yeah, more times than I wanted to be honest. I mean, I'd love to be able to sit here and go, oh, yeah, tell wonderful stories about, you know, Stirling opposite, locking it through the Brecon Beacons or whatever. My experience of being in a Stirling... with Stirling in a car, my memories is largely being... terrified, and when I wasn't terrified, being slightly embarrassed. Stirling wasn't great in traffic, heavy traffic, and because he lived in the middle of London, you couldn't go anywhere with Stirling without being in heavy traffic. We had, years back, we had a deal. There was a magazine, Orient Express magazine, and he had a column in it, which I ghosted for him, and the deal was I'd turn up at Shepherd Street once a quarter in some interesting car, we'd go for a drive, he'd talk to me, I'd record the conversation, I'd write the story, and we'd split the fee. And so that's why I spent a lot of time in road cars with Stirling, usually in traffic jams. And yeah, it didn't bring out the best of the boy, to be honest. But, you know, we all have our flaws and everybody put up with him. I don't know whether somehow they kind of knew that this was some special bloke. But nobody, despite the fact that he was, you know, really fairly impatient with other road users. I don't remember him ever getting any rude signs or anything else. He just sort of serenely carried on his way.
What did he make of the road cars that you took him to have a look at?
It varied. He was you know, because to be honest, he wasn't that current on a lot of the stuff that was out there. He didn't really know what to compare it, a lot of it to. So, I mean, he would take a bit of a steer from me on that because I obviously was in and out of everything. But the thing about Stirling was he just, you know, he loved cars. It's like he loved motor racing. You know, he would, I don't imagine that Stirling ever missed a Formula One race. You know, he was, you know, if you wanted to talk, I can remember Alonso back in his really, really early days. I think he was in a Minardi and he got massively criticised because there was some accident, maybe at Interlagos, and he was the only person who didn't lift. And he went on and he had a massive accident himself and everybody was okay. And I can remember saying to Stirling, you know, what do you think of that? Weren't you appalled by his behaviour? Stirling looked at me and he said, no, I thought future world champion. He backed himself. He just thought, I can deal with this. And okay, it turned out he was wrong. But Stirling saw that confidence. Stirling saw that commitment and thought, world champion. And guess what?
He was absolutely right. We've spoken a little bit about how adaptable he was. He could transfer his skill into all sorts of different machinery and different disciplines as well. He was a skilled rally driver, for instance. Second on Rally Monte Carlo in 1952. Second overall, that is. One of the more curious episodes in his career, though, Andrew, came in the very early 80s when he had a go in the British Touring Car Championship with Audi. What can you tell us about that?
I can tell you that it's the one thing in his career Stirling bitterly regretted doing. So it was an Audi 80 BTCC drive. You know, Stirling had four things going against him. One was that he was 50 years old. Two was that he hadn't raced competitively for 18 years. Three was the car was front-wheel drive, which he'd never driven before. Four was the car was on slicks, which he'd never driven on before. So, I mean, I'm sure that if he'd, you know, had his time again and looked at it in those terms, he would have realised that, you know, he was on a hiding to nothing. And to be honest, that's how it turned out. You know, it wasn't a very... Well, it wasn't in any way a pleasant experience for him. You know, he was, you know, down the back, I think made worse by the fact that his teammate was some bloke called Martin Brundle. And we all know how good he turned out to be. And you know, it was a very, very difficult experience for him. Just once, there was one race. I wish I could remember all the details. I know it was at Brands Hatch. And I know more than anything that it rained. And on just that one occasion, Stirling found himself on a tyre that he understood. And, you know, he'd started off way down the back. And by the time the car broke, as it frequently did, I think he was third. He basically carved through the entire field. And people were thinking, well, hang on, who's this bloke? You know, suddenly the old guy at the back has learned how to drive. And suddenly he was Stirling Moss again. I remember seeing it at a Goodwood Revival too. When Stirling was really quite old, he was in a Maserati 250F, and on the Saturday he'd qualified it down the back, and every, you know, which was where you would expect Stirling to be because he was an old bloke by then, and back, you know, as you know, in the Revival you have proper hotshot racing drivers, and then on race day, it rained and it rained and it rained and it rained, and people were pinging off left, right, and centre. Stirling just seemed to be on a different track to everyone else. And, you know, he just didn't have enough laps. You know, I think he'd started something like, I don't know, 14th or 15th, and he was up to third or second by the time he just ran out of laps. But if the race had been another couple of laps longer, he'd have won it.
Can you tell us a little bit now about the void that he leaves behind, maybe from a personal point of view, but also from the point of view of motorsport as a whole?
Yeah, it's interesting. In motorsport, because there aren't people like Stirling out there anymore, you know, they're all very, very different animals. You know, Formula One isn't going to change because Stirling Moss is no longer with us. You know, I think that there will be a lot of heartfelt things said about him. You know, there already have. You know, Lewis, I know, revered the bloke. But, you know, the world goes on. And, you know, the truth is, apart from the unfortunate Audi experience, you know, it's almost 60 years since Stirling Moss raced a car professionally, which is, you know, the thick end of a lifetime to most people. So in that regard, the void is not that big. But I think to those of us who regard racing as, as a philosophy, as an approach, almost as a romantic thing, the way Stirling went racing, how incredibly proper he was in his conduct, inside and outside a racing car. I don't think you cannot feel a sense of loss that probably, frankly, our greatest connection to that time has now gone. And, you know, I guess it just, for me, it just comes back to just this sense of the most immense good fortune to have been able to, you know, download him on a number of occasions about, you know, about those times, because in my head lives in 2020, as all of us must, but my heart lives, you know, in the 50s and 60s, early 60s, before I was born, you know, when Stirling Moss ruled the world.
He leaves behind his wife, Lady Susie, and two grown-up children. Andrew, I saw you describe Lady Susie as his greatest ever teammate. It would be criminal, really, to close off this podcast without a word for her. So what can you tell us about her?
Oh, Susie, she is absolutely brilliant. I mean, a superb person. I said she was Stirling's greatest teammate in a tweet to Martin Brundle, without realising at the time, of course, that Martin had been Stirling's teammate. But Martin, of all people, will understand exactly what I mean. She was his rock in every possible way. The support, the mental, emotional, social, professional, personal, I mean, every way you can measure it. She was the person who just made it all happen for Stirling. You know, Stirling Moss was an amazing person, but certainly for the 40 years that they were married, you know, Susie's role in that, you know, cannot be underestimated. She was his manager. She did everything for him. And on top of that, she is one of the warmest, funniest, lovely people you could ever wish to meet. I mean, and you know, I can remember we were doing some race at Spa, and it was all over, and I went up to the hospitality unit to say goodbye to the chap who ran the race team that I'd been driving for. And they were clearing out the hospitality, and I noticed this lady with a black bin liner going around picking up litter off the ground. And I thought, hang on, I recognise her. And it was Susie. She was just picking up rubbish in the hospitality suite, because that was a job that needed doing, so she'd do it. And that's the kind of person Susie is. She's like Stirling. She had no ego, no airs, no graces, just an immensely warm, funny, lovely person who was Stirling's, you know, right arm, left arm, rock, whatever you want to call it, for the last 40 years of his life. And as I say, you know, her role in his life cannot be underestimated.
She sounds like a wonderful person. I have only one Stirling Moss memory to share with you, Andrew, and this was several years ago now, I think maybe 2011, 2012, reasonably soon after Stirling fell down his lift shaft at home and injured himself quite badly. And I was at the Silverstone Classic, and I remember being stood in the pit lane watching Stirling being wheeled up in a wheelchair, still with bandages around his ankles, and he very gingerly lifted himself out of the wheelchair into a 50s Grand Prix car, and then went tearing out of the pit lane like he was 24 again. And it was wonderful to watch.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I mean, people talk about the accident he had at Spa where he broke his back, and obviously the Goodwood accident. But I think Stirling's greatest Houdini moment probably was the lift shaft incident, because I think he was 80 when he went down. He went down a lift shaft, I've been in Stirling's house a few times, and I know just how far he fell. I mean, it was a long way, and he did terrible damage to his. To his ankles and his heels, and I can remember he was in hospital, and I can remember thinking to myself, well, you know, fair enough, you know, I'm sure you'll get better. It's obviously going to take, you know, an awful lot of time, but you know, clearly you're never going to drive another car, let alone demonstrate a racing car, let alone actually race one. And he did. He did. I mean, you know, at the age of, you know, 81, he was back in his Oscar and he was racing it, having been down the lift shot. I mean, they just, there is some weird material they made that man out of, which, you know, just the rest of us have not been able to enjoy. He was, well, you know, I thought he was indestructible. And over the last 2 years that he's been, you know, that he has been, you know, fairly bedbound, you know, there was always just that maybe even, you know, Sterling will find a way of beating this one too, but very sadly, not this time.
What a remarkable guy he was, and actually a real privilege and great fun, Andrew, to hear you talk about him, the racing driver, but more importantly, him, the man. Can you, just to close this off now, how will you remember Sir Stirling Moss?
Oh, gosh, on so many levels. I think I only really... I mean, we all know what a hero is. We all know it's the most overused word in the dictionary. But there are, you know, there are proper heroes. There are guys who sort of go out in minefields and earn Victoria Crosses. And there's that kind of heroes. And then there's the sort of personal hero. And I think, to be honest, I've only ever had two. One was Ayrton Senna and the other was Stirling Moss. And he was a hero to me. Absolutely not because he was quick on a racing car. He was a hero to me because not because of, you know, what he won, but you know, and the cars that he raced, but how he went racing. He, to me, he embodied all that was great about racing, all that made me fall in love with racing. He was an incredible driver, but he was an incredibly correct driver as well. And just a role model, the role model of role models. And then when I got to know him, the best of blokes as well. And I feel incredibly proud, privileged and lucky to have been able to spend any time with him, let alone to race with him, let alone to laugh with him. Blessed is the word, the only word I can think of to tell you how I feel about having known Stirling.
Yeah. Well, listen, thank you so much for sharing. I've really enjoyed listening. I hope all of you listening enjoyed that too. Please remember to leave some feedback where you can, subscribe to the Drive Nation podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back soon to bring you more podcasts. But Andrew, I hope that was okay for you to talk about Sir Stirling Moss that way so soon after he passed away.
Yeah, I did worry about it a bit, Dan, because it's all still fairly recent and all fairly raw, and there'll be lots of people who knew Stirling, you know, some of them, you know, much better than me, who will be grieving a lot. But I think, you know, please let's not remember the last 2 years. Let's remember the 88 before that, the 88 great years that man had. Because he was a truly great and wonderful person, and his life is one of all to be celebrated. And I hope that's, you know, in the last however long we've been chatting, that's what we've been able to do, because goodness knows that's what Stirling would have wanted us to do.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.